It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a guest from the Center for the Study of Men and Masculinities about efforts to bring men to the table when it comes to preventing campus rape and sexual assault.
First, Governor Walker announced this week that he set up a new committee called Our American Revival to help promote his messages and cover costs as he prepares to announce a likely bid for the 2016 Republican nomination.
The creation of the organization is not an announcement that he'll run, but it's a big step in that direction. Our American Revival is a 527 group that is not permitted to campaign for the election or defeat of any particular candidate. That line can be a little gray at times, though.
Here to explain exactly what a 527 committee is and what it can and cannot do is Ken Mayer. He's a professor of political science at UW-Madison and an expert in campaign finance. Ken, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So 527. Let's nuts and bolts it. What is it?
So a 527 is, it refers to a section of the Internal Revenue Code that specifies that money that is raised and spent, but raised is the key part here, that is spent for what the IRS calls an exempt function, which is anything that's designed to influence an election in the broadest sense, that money is not taxable as income. And what this means is that virtually every political organization, the political parties, primary candidate campaign committees, political action committees, they are all 527s. Whether or not a 527 has to do other things, report to the Federal Election Commission, abide by campaign finance restrictions on amounts and sources, those are all depend on the types of things that a 527 does that bring them under that umbrella. This 527, Our American Revival, is a general promotion device for Walker that actually doesn't even mention him in its papers that it filed with the FEC. But what it allows it to do is that as long as he is not formally a candidate for president, it allows them to promote him and his ideas without abiding by or without being subject to contribution limits or source restrictions. So it's an intermediate step between not having any kind of organization to promote him, and if, as it seems likely at this point, he does become a candidate, the formal presidential campaign committee that he would have to form in order to raise money to actually run for the nomination as a candidate.
Now, you mentioned the papers filed. You actually have said papers in front of you, a copy of them anyway. Is there anything that caught your eye here?
Well, the couple of interesting things. One is that the application itself is very, very short. It's just 3 pages, and the only substantive element of that is a section where it describes the purpose, and I'll read it. It says, "Our American Revival is an organization that will communicate a vision and work to enact policies that will lead to a freer and more prosperous America for all by restoring power to the states and, more importantly, the people." And it goes on in that vein for another sentence. And that just is, as I read it, designed to qualify the organization as a 527, which, in a generic sense, constitutes an effort to engage in influencing elections, which is often, when it gets defined, as anything related to politics, without, for someone like Walker, who is not yet a candidate. And a lot of the discussion consists of distinguishing why Walker did this as opposed to some of the other things that he might have done, created a leadership PAC or created what is commonly known as a super PAC. And the reason is those types of organizations do different things which this organization will not be able to do. It won't be able to contribute money to candidates. It won't be able to expressly advocate for the election of defeat of Walker or anybody else. But it's a generic promotion organization.
And in terms of how big a bellwether this is, tipping Scott Walker's hand about a run, what does this tell you? What, now that he's got this 527, is this something that pretty much is what you do when you're going to run for president?
Right. So in the absence of an absolute signal, we are, all of us who are not part of his inner circle, or he may not have even expressed it to people, we're surmising. And this, what I can say is I think at this point it's very likely that he's going to announce. And all of the things that he has been doing over the past few weeks and months are all pointed in that direction. And the reason I think this step is significant, that it's clear enough that if for some reason he decides that he's not going to announce, the question would be, what changed? Why aren't you announcing? What is it that happened between the time that you established this 527 or the time that you hired some experienced campaign people? What changed your mind? And that would be something that you would have to explain. So again, it's not a certainty, but all of the signals are at this point are certainly pointing in that direction.
Are there specific limits with this 527? You mentioned some of them, but are there things here that would signal anything to you?
Well, as this organization is constructed, there are no limits. They can take unlimited contributions. There are no source restrictions. They can take it can take corporate money, unlimited individual contributions. There are disclosure requirements. Those will come in after. They're not immediate. And if at some point Walker does become a candidate, then you start kicking in some of the restrictions about depending on what the organization does with disclosure and whether it would have to file with the FEC. But campaign finance laws, as the result of Supreme Court decisions, Citizens United, Speech Now versus the FEC. Even when we're dealing with candidates, independent groups, super PACs, groups like Citizens United, independent groups that are not coordinating with the candidate can now spend corporate money, unlimited individual money, and there are fewer limits. The one place where the campaign finance limits remain in force is actual money that is contributed to candidate campaign committees, candidate organizations, and those have contribution limits, disclosures, and source restrictions.
Now, this week, Governor Walker's Our American Revival, this 527, released its first ad, and it begins by characterizing the United States' current policies as failing, and it continues with this. Let's listen.
To reclaim our destiny, we must turn to bold, fresh, and new ideas from those incubators of reform, the states.
The folks in Washington like this top-down approach that's old and artificial and outdated that says the government knows best. We believe that you should build the economy from the ground up.
And that's exactly what states like Wisconsin are doing, leading America's revival with bold conservative reform and new ideas.
The first ad from Scott Walker's Our American Revival 527. So what's different between that ad and what you would call a political ad per se?
Well, this clearly is a political ad, but the basic meaning of this ad, you can only interpret them by the actual text. You can't look at things like the subtext or intent of the people who are running it. So if you didn't know anything else about the candidates or the organization, you would look at this ad and say, oh, it's an ad that promotes conservative ideas from the states, using Wisconsin as an example. It doesn't even mention the name Scott Walker, at least verbally, although it, clearly it's the speech that the speeches that he has given. But the jurisprudence on campaign finance going back decades is very, very clear that the only thing that matters at this point is essentially who is running the ad, whether it's a campaign committee or if it's an outside group, whether it is coordinated with the campaign. Outside of that, independent groups, whether they're corporations or labor unions, can use explicit language. Here it's a little bit tricky because Walker is not yet formally a candidate, and so it'd be in touchy ground if they began to promote him as a presidential candidate, but we'll start to see that from organizations, if not quite this one, if he chooses to run.
Well, let's talk about that. So what happens to this committee exactly if / when Governor Walker announces that he's running for president?
Well, it's not clear. One of the things that does happen is that an independent group like Our American Revival, which is not yet expressly advocating for a candidate, it can't coordinate. In other words, that an independent group can run all the ads at once and say whatever it wants about a candidate, but as soon as they begin to strategize with or coordinate with a candidate committee, then the rules change, and anything it does becomes a contribution. And this is actually one of the issues involved in the John Doe investigations, is whether whether a group can coordinate and still engage in independent spending. Right now, the state of the law from the Supreme Court is that you cannot coordinate. But my guess is that if he becomes a formal candidate, this group the structure will change, or the personnel will change, so that they can have some distance. And whether or not they can do that in a way that is distant enough so that it wouldn't be coordinated, even though, I mean, Scott Walker issued the press release announcing its formation. That's a technical issue that the lawyers would probably have to figure out. But my guess is that at the point when he becomes a formally announced candidate, there'd be no need for a group like this, because you don't need an intermediate step at that point.
Well, Ken, thanks a lot for coming on and explaining it all to us.
My pleasure.
We've been speaking with Ken Mayer, professor of political science at UW-Madison and an expert on campaign finance, talking about Governor Walker's new 527 advocacy group. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
We're talking about the problem of rape and sexual assault on college campuses in the United States. This isn't a new problem, but it's gotten new national attention in the last year or so. By different estimates, between 1 in 6 or 1 in 3 female students experience rape or sexual assault during their college careers. The president has spoken out against the problem of sexual assault on campus, and the Justice Department is investigating several dozen schools for potentially mishandling rape complaints.
Much of the national conversation on this topic is focused on reducing binge drinking on campus and prosecuting perpetrators. Men aren't always brought into the forefront of the discussion of how to stop this problem, but some activists are trying to change the dialogue to include men.
And we want to hear from you. Have you seen these problems as a student, maybe a parent, or somebody working on campus? What do you think needs to change on U.S. campuses to discourage rape? And what should we expect from college-age men? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Cliff Leek is with us to talk about some male-oriented solutions to campus sexual assault and rape. He's the program director for the Center for the Study of Men and Masculinities and a PhD student at Stony Brook University. He's also a former prevention specialist for the Oregon Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. Cliff, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the scope of the problem, some widely varying estimates of how many women this affects, a lot of media attention. How big a problem is this that we're trying to tackle here?
I think it's absolutely a huge one. As you mentioned sort of up top, it's anywhere between 1 in 3 and 1 in 6 women on college campuses is what most of the credible research is saying, which, you know, if you're at either end of that spectrum, it's still a disturbingly high number.
Is this particularly a problem on college campuses, or is this something that is wider spread among that age group?
It's definitely an age group problem, I think, more than a campus problem. In fact, there was a recent article in the Chronicle of Higher Education that talks about how it's actually the age group of 18 to 24 where sexual violence is so prevalent, and there's actually a lot of debates in the research over whether it's actually more prevalent on college campuses than it is elsewhere. But really what we do know is it's more than anything else, it's prevalent in that age group.
And why are we spending, or why are we hearing so much focus on campuses in particular then, do you think?
There's a few things. I think one is that we look to college campuses as sort of bastions of you know, safe places to have important discussions, right? And when you have sexual violence so prominent in those places, then how can those be safe places for education and safe places for people to have the important conversations that we imagine college students having? I think that's one part of it. The other part of it is that Title IX specifically requires that colleges and universities make campuses safe spaces for all students, and specifically for women. And when you have rates of sexual violence this high, clearly that's evidence that they're failing to meet that requirement.
As we mentioned, a lot of the attention goes to binge drinking or social situations involving drinking to policing this sort of thing, and we can get into that a little more. But let's talk about somewhat you're focusing on, trying to bring men into the conversation, change, I guess, men's attitudes. Why is it important to do this?
Well, so often when we talk about the problem of sexual violence on not only on campuses, but even more broadly, we talk about how we respond to it. And very rarely do we talk about what we can actually do to prevent it from even happening in the first place. And when we do even talk about prevention, we talk about, okay, well, let's put safety lights on campus. Let's increase campus security and things like that. But that really doesn't stop it from becoming a problem in the first place. It's more ways to respond once a perpetrator has made the decision to perpetrate, right? So this conversation about engaging men and boys is really like let's move upstream on the problem. Let's see if we can find the source of the problem and address it before it even becomes an issue in the first place.
So it sounds like a good idea in the abstract. How do you do that? How do you get men on campuses, in this case, talking about sexual assault and changing their own attitudes and maybe being contagious about that changing attitude?
Right. So, of course, that's the hard part. So there's a lot of work being done on college campuses around this by a wide variety of different nonprofits. There's some really great ones like Green Dot and Men Can Stop Rape that are going onto college campuses and trying to encourage these conversations. One of the most important conversations that's happening is around masculinity. So if we can actually change the way that young men think about what it means to be a man, that is often related to how we think about what good sex is and how we're supposed to go about obtaining sex, right? Because oftentimes that for young men, that's how sex is framed. Is it something that, okay, well, how do I get a yes instead of, okay, well, how do we have this experience together, right?
So is part of the concept here, in addition, I guess, to the negatives, these are things men shouldn't do. You're trying to have some positives. These are ways that men should aspire to. This should be a positive element of masculinity.
Right. So when you look around at the young men in our day-to-day lives, the vast majority of young men would never even think for a moment about perpetrating sexual violence. But the problem is that the vast majority of men also wouldn't stand up and say something about it when they see behaviors that lead to sexual violence, or for that matter, don't know how to recognize behaviors that lead to sexual violence. So one of the things that a lot of this work to engage men and boys is doing is let's stop looking at men as just perpetrators, because perpetrators are such a small proportion of men. And instead, let's look at men as potential change agents. Men can talk to other men about these issues in ways that we haven't in the past. And if we really want to change how we think about masculinity, oftentimes those messages have to come from our fellow men.
These sound like difficult conversations. It sounds like something that it might be hard to get men to own up to these issues, to start talking about them. You've been working with programs and looking at programs like this around the country. Is this right, or is there a hunger among college-age men to have these conversations?
Well, it's a mixed bag. I would argue that the toughest part is getting the men to come to the table in the first place. Because there's so much stigma around men talking about these issues. But once we have men to the table and engaging in the discussion, that is where we do see that hunger that you're talking about.
So how do you get men to come to the table in the first place then?
Well, that's you're asking the tough questions. So different campaigns are trying different things. So, for example, Men Can Stop Rape has a My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, which really is it's an ad campaign to try to get men to rethink what strength is and means, and at the same time invites them to have those conversations with other men. Green Dot trains peer educators to interrupt behaviors and start those conversations sort of on the fly where they're happening, whether it's at a party or in a dorm or whatever, training peer educators to have those conversations on the fly. But there are also a lot of campuses that have groups of young men. For instance, 6-7 years ago, I was a part of the Willamette University Men Against Violence, which was just a group of 6 or 7 of us that got together every couple of weeks to talk about this stuff and talk about how we can get other men on campus to talk about it.
A lot of the blame gets put on fraternities, maybe fairly in some cases, maybe unfairly in others. But is that a place where you try to take these messages?
Yes, absolutely. So there are campaigns specifically addressed at fraternities, as well as at college athletics as well. There's a great program, MVP, Mentors in Violence Prevention, that targets college athletes. I think oftentimes fraternities are unfairly targeted, not because it's not prominent in fraternities, but because it's prominent in other all-male spaces as well. So you look at fraternities, you look at athletics, you look at the military, you find that in spaces that are male-dominated or all-male, this problem seems to be more prevalent.
We're talking to Cliff Leek from the Center for the Study of Men and Masculinities about how to include men in the discussion about preventing campus rape and sexual assault.
And we're taking your calls on this. How do you think we should change our expectations for the behavior of men in college? How can we get men to come to the table for that conversation about preventing rape on campus? And what role would you like to see men play? Call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farah. News is next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farah. We're picking up our discussion with Cliff Leek from the Center for the Study of Men and Masculinities, talking about how we can include men when it comes to preventing rape and sexual assault on college campuses.
And we'd love to hear from you on this. How would you like to see our standards for the behavior of men on college campuses change? And what role would you like to see men play when it comes to preventing rape and sexual assault? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Let's go right to a caller. We've got Michelle on the line in Madison. Michelle, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about or ask us, Michelle?
I wanted to give my opinion. I'm actually a rape survivor. I was attacked when I was a sophomore in college at UW-Madison. And I've got two boys. They're 14 and 12 years old. And my thought on this is that by the time men have gotten to college, that so many of their opinions and their values have already been formed about how they see women. And I think that this conversation needs to start well before they get to college, even in middle school and high school, when they're starting to learn about sex education. And one of the things that I've done with my boys is talking to them about this and told them that one of the things that I expect of them is that they need to be on the lookout for guys that talk poorly about women who could likely be perpetrators, and that I'm encouraging them to stand up and you know, tell them that what they're saying is wrong, and be champions for the girls and their friends in their life. But I think by the time they get to college, if someone's going to be a perpetrator, that's going to be established before they get to that age.
Michelle, thanks a lot for the call. I'm very sorry about your experience in college. A couple of big points there, I think, Cliff. First of all, the idea that maybe college is too late. We need to be having these conversations with boys, not with men at that point.
I think she's absolutely right. But I also think it's a both and. I don't think it's too late once we reach college to have those conversations. In fact, because I've seen a lot of young men go through huge transformations by having these conversations in college. But that being said, I also think that we'd be far better off if we had these conversations earlier. So we have programs that are working with boys in elementary and high school. There are also programs even working with fathers and trying to help fathers be parents who can address these issues with their young boys long before they ever reach college.
And Michelle also mentioned not just the when, but the what the message is. And her message was not just, you know, don't be a perpetrator yourself, but intervene. So let's talk about, as you're training at whatever age, what kind of positive things do we want to see from boys, from young men, to intervene, to try to prevent their peers from being perpetrators?
So one of the things that happens a lot on college campuses is this training on interventions. In fact, there's a buzzword for it on campuses now, bystander interventions. So how can men who are bystanders learn to intervene when they see violence occurring? And I think that's really important, but at the same time, how often do we actually witness the violence occurring? And I would argue that that's really rare. But what we can train folks to intervene on is a lot of cultural teaching moments. So, for example, you're hearing folks tell rape jokes, or you're hearing folks tell jokes. You're hearing young men tell jokes about women and joking about women's bodies and things like that. Those are places where we can intervene and start to shift the culture. Those are places where men can be trained to sort of step in and start a conversation. Not necessarily a, you know, hey, how dare you say that? That's wrong. But a, hey, what do you mean by that? Let's talk about it. Let's change the way we think about these things a bit.
So if those things aren't challenged, everybody thinks everybody else thinks that way and maybe conforms to it over time?
Right. There's a lot of data from perpetrators, interviews with perpetrators, that basically shows that they think that all men think like them. And I think that's something that we can really start to change in our culture. I strongly believe that a lot less men would be perpetrators if there was a better sense that that's not normal, that's not acceptable, and that's not how we do things.
Michelle, thanks again for your call. Brought us to a lot of interesting points there. Michael is with us next in Superior. Michael, hi.
Hello, and thanks for listening. I thought the guest was going to go right about where the person that just called in. I'm a strong believer that there's two frontiers here. There's the adults, young people who were, let's say, 16 and older, heading to the campus. The difficulty is, of course, they've kind of locked into their mentality or been locked out one way or the other. And I think the second frontier, which is really the first frontier, is that we really need to provide parenting tools for a whole host of things, and especially for creating in the minds of our young people, men and women, who they are and how important they are to themselves and to others. And that is not happening. Young people are not talked to about these issues up front and center by mother or dad.
Interesting, Michael. I want to jump in and get Cliff Leek in on that. So again, getting to the parenting side, but do we need help not just working with kids, say, at school? Do parents need help in talking about these issues, Cliff?
I think they really do. In fact, and that's also not just a problem in the U.S. I would argue that that's a problem globally. There's a really great new global campaign on this issue called Men Care, which is all about training fathers to be able to have these conversations with their sons, training fathers on being able to be vulnerable with their sons and show and display to their sons a different way of being men.
Thanks a lot for the call, Michael. Kenneth had called in to say he thinks a lot of this problem, campus sexual assault, has to do with alcohol. And that gets a lot of the focus, alcohol-rich environments on campuses. I mean, we're talking about other things here, but is that something we need to address as part of this, Cliff?
There's no doubt that alcohol is linked to sexual violence, but not necessarily in the ways that a lot of people think. So the vast majority of the time, survivors of sexual violence do report that they were intoxicated at the time. And perpetrators of sexual violence are also often intoxicated at the time. However, what we know from interviews with perpetrators is that usually it's not just the alcohol isn't just part of the environment. It's often used as a tool. So it's used as a tool to debilitate victims, as well as used as a tool by perpetrators as an excuse for their behavior. So I think alcohol is an important part of the conversation, but not as too often when we talk about alcohol, we say, well, you know, everyone was drinking, therefore it was he said, she said, no one really knows what happens. But most of the data says that that's not the case.
Getting back to definitions of masculinity, I mean, for years, decades, we've been talking about gender roles being in flux and some kind of transition here in the United States, maybe around the world. And we don't know what masculinity is anymore. How does that play into this discussion, do you think, on campus rape and sexual assault?
I think that masculinity is constantly changing, as you're saying. And in terms of campus sexual violence, I think young men maybe haven't been prepared adequately to, you know, coexist, cohabitate with women on college campuses. There's a great deal of gender segregation in our schooling, not by, you know, mandatory, you know, men in this boys in this classroom and girls in this classroom, but there's a great deal of cultural voluntary gender segregation in such a way that a lot of young men come to college campuses without having had much intimate contact with women. And as a result of that, don't really know what their masculinity is in relationship to women, which is a recipe for disaster when suddenly you're living in the same dorm and don't know how to interact. But everything that you're seeing in the media, everything that you're hearing from your peers is sex is something to obtain and to achieve. And if that's what you're told and don't have experience that says otherwise, then that's really a recipe for disaster.
You know, we've been focusing on sexual assault and rape on campus. And as you said at the outset, this is an age group problem, too, 18 to 24, not just on campuses. Seems like the campus part might be the easy part here because you know where the men are. There are easy ways to reach them. Are there efforts to take these similar efforts off of campus into the rest of that 18, 24 male population?
Not as much as I would like to see. I think that oftentimes when we think of the 18 to 24 age group, it's all too easy for us to assume that they're all college students and for us to focus all of our time and our energy and our money on college students. So a lot of this work is being done on college campuses because there's funding from the Violence Against Women Act, there's funding from the Department of Education, there's funding from Title IX, there's plenty of funding to do this work. I shouldn't say plenty, there's never quite enough funding, but there's a lot more funding to do this work on college campuses with that 18 to 24 age group than there is to do this work off of college campuses with that 18 to 24 age group. So I think that we do need to take this work beyond college campuses and find new and innovative ways of doing that.
Now, if you track the news and go looking for it, there's a steady stream of stories of sexual assault and rape on campuses, trials that ensue, that sort of thing. How optimistic are you, though, that there's light at the end of the tunnel, that things are getting better, that we can reduce the number of sexual assaults that happen on campuses?
One of the things that you hear a lot when we talk about reports of sexual violence on college campuses, when you talk to researchers that know this data really, really well, what they tell you is that you know a campus is doing a good job of addressing sexual violence when reporting goes up. So actually, when campuses are changing, you hear more conversation about it. You see the reports go up. So it seems like, oh my gosh, sexual violence is suddenly becoming a huge problem on this campus. But that's not the case. It's actually that it's been a problem on the campus for a long time. But women on campus are feeling more comfortable to report, feeling more comfortable to come forward with accusations, feeling more comfortable to do something about it, which is a big sign of progress. So I think that when we look around at the national media and we see all of these stories coming out, it seems like every week a new story about sexual assault on a college campus, it's easy to get to feel like, oh gosh, we're not getting anywhere. But I think that we can sort of flip the script on that a little bit and think of that as a sign that we're finally having this conversation about something that's been a problem for a very long time.
Cliff, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you.
That's Cliff Leek. He's program coordinator for the Center for the Study of Men and Masculinities. He's a PhD student at Stony Brook University.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
We're talking with news guy Noah Ovshinsky about this week's top state headlines. With those UW system funding cuts and a new arena proposed for Milwaukee, a lot to talk about.
Noah joins us every week at this time. He's our assistant news director here at Wisconsin Public Radio. Noah, welcome back.
It is good to be here. Happy Friday, Rob.
Happy Friday to you, too. Well, Governor Walker has been doing something a little different this budget time. He's been giving little bits and pieces of what's coming in next Tuesday's address.
Yes, some breadcrumbs, I'd say. Rather large breadcrumbs.
These are large, yeah. A lot of people are pouncing on these breadcrumbs. Well, I'll stop the metaphor there. A lot of big things, and the biggest, probably the thing that's gotten the most attention, this proposal for the UW system.
Right, by far. So earlier this week, the governor announced that in his next budget, he will have a proposal where he's going to cut the UW budget by $300 million, while at the same time giving it autonomy, more autonomy. Essentially, the governor wants to turn the system over to a public authority that would have more control over things like payroll, tuition, building construction, et cetera, et cetera.
All right, a little history here. There was a kerfluffle over a similar-ish thing from one of the campuses.
Right. So it's similar to an idea that was floated a few years ago that was eventually shot down involving UW-Madison. There was this idea of taking UW-Madison, separating it from the system, and turning it over to a public authority. This proposal, as opposed to just one campus, will take the entire system and convert it to an authority.
All right, no surprise here. A lot of people have been sounding off on this issue. We've heard some of them here on this show. What are we hearing from around the state here?
Yeah, and the reactions vary depending on you know, whether you're a member of the legislature, faculty, administration, the public, students. And really, as I said, you know, the reactions were varied. UW-Madison Chancellor Rebecca Blank says, you know, that these cuts certainly will lead to layoffs. Gary Miller, the chancellor of UW-Green Bay, says this kind of cut could affect the programs the school runs with community organizations.
And the people are going to get a crack at this are in the state legislature. We heard one Republican legislator, Nealon, Representative Nealon, said he likes the autonomy idea, just worried about tuition going up. Any other striking notes from the legislature?
Absolutely. Representative Steve Noss, who, you know, is a frequent critic.
If there's news about the UW, he's going to have something to say about it.
Yes, longtime critic of the UW system. He also chairs the Assembly Committee on Colleges and Universities. So, again, somebody who's going to be deeply involved in what this proposal ends up being. He was sort of deeply skeptical of what the system would do if they had the power to raise tuition, for instance, as the governor's plan gives them after 2017.
So this hasn't been presented yet. Is he already suggesting changes to what the governor's talking about?
Right. He's actually suggested two changes even before the budget address. Noss wants to shorten the term of the Board of Regents from 7 to 3 years. He argues that these shorter terms will improve accountability, assuming that the Board of Regents is ultimately who's in charge of this new public authority governing the system. He would like them to serve shorter terms. The other thing Steve Noss would like is he wants to cap tuition increases, again, one of his primary concerns with giving the UW more autonomy. He'd like to cap tuition increases to the level of the Consumer Price Index, also known as the CPI.
So what does the big boss of the UW system, system president Ray Cross, say about all this?
So he has said that this greater flexibility that the governor's plan affords is a good thing. That said, he says he will fight hard to shrink the size of this cut. And, you know, frankly, there's also been some frustration expressed publicly, actually, by President Cross on the issue of faculty workload.
So what's been – he's responding to the governor there, right?
Yeah. So the governor had said in comments earlier this week that the university could use this new freedom that this public authority would bring to require faculty to teach more, in essence teach more and at the same time cutting costs and that sort of thing. And that prompted this idea of, you know, requiring faculty to teach more. That prompted a really strong response from President Cross. In fact, on the Joy Cardine show here on WPR, Cross said, you know, such talk really frustrates him. He said it was a shame that people didn't understand what faculty do. He went on to compare faculty to state legislators, actually. He said, you know, and I'm paraphrasing here, you know, that one does not get a good sense of everything lawmakers do if you just looked at what they did when they were actually technically in session. I mean, they're only in session a few months a year. Cross says basically the same idea applies to faculty. There's a lot more that goes into the job.
Well, a lot of listeners will be wondering what this is going to mean for tuition, for quality of education, and after five, we'll hear from a guest who's tackling some of those issues. Based on what we know so far, a lot could change in the next couple of months, though. Well, also, another big item in this budget, there's been a lot of attention to this proposed arena in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
It would house the Milwaukee Bucks, but also host other things, events, concerts, that sort of thing.
And specifically, how would such an arena be paid for?
Right.
And if so, would it lead to the Bucks actually staying in Milwaukee? The governor announced this week that in his next budget, he's going to actually seek an arrangement that will lead to the construction of the new arena for the Milwaukee Bucks. Walker says he wants to use $220 million in state-issued bonds to help pay for it. Basically, he says, you know, if nothing is done, there is a good chance that the team could leave.
Mm-hmm. And where does he see that money coming from to pay off those bonds? That's the key here.
Yeah, right. Where's the money going to come from? The governor expects the state will actually get paid back over time through taxes, specifically the taxes that NBA players will be paying to the state in the future.
Right, and they're expected to make more money thanks to unrelated TV deals.
Yeah, exactly. Things having to do with TV and other contracts.
Okay, again, the reaction to this. Bring us forward a little here.
Well, you know, this idea of using taxpayer money to pay for these kinds of projects, always controversial. Here, other cities across the United States. You know, there are people and groups out there who just don't think arenas should be paid for using taxpayer money. Americans for Prosperity, for instance, has said it should not be the responsibility of the state or taxpayers to pick up the bill. State Representative Corey Mason of Racine, you know, certainly he says he wants the Bucks to stay in Milwaukee, but he criticized, you know, this idea of giving them state support at the same time that the governor is also proposing to cut the UW by $300 million.
All right. Well, that's another one we're going to be watching as it moves through the budget process. We've heard some big things about what's coming on Tuesday.
Very big.
One thing you and I have talked about, and you and Veronica have talked a lot about, transportation funding, how we pay for it.
Yes.
It's going to be something in the budget. We don't know what yet.
Yeah, that is one of the elephants in the room, is how are we going to pay for the roads here in the state? There are a lot of competing proposals that have surfaced in recent months from lawmakers, from the Department of Transportation itself. And there's a lot of disagreement as to how we're going to pay for it. Is it going to be more bonding? Are we going to reformulate the gas tax to raise more money? Are we going to charge hybrid owners more money to buy hybrid and electric cars? Is there going to be a new tax or an additional tax on automotive-related purchases, perhaps like an increased sales tax for automotive products? These are all ideas that have been floated around and have all proven to be quite controversial. Again, we haven't heard anything really about transportation this week from the governor, so we'll all be paying attention to that.
Yeah, it seems like there's a consensus that there needs to be something. There are a lot of ideas. Nobody likes any of them.
That's about it. Yeah, so end of story. That's basically
it. The governor has to tackle that.
Yeah,
there.
That's it.
Okay, a huge part of the state budget, K-12 funding, public schools, and beyond.
Yeah.
We've gotten some hints there.
A little bit. The governor said he'll provide additional aid to rural schools this week. He also said that he's going to try to keep K-12 funding, I'm going to use his words here, largely intact. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, again, we'll have to see what he has to say next week.
Okay. Medicaid. There's some news here and in Indiana,
right,
about Medicaid funding from the federal government.
Right. So he hasn't really said what he plans to do on the Medicaid front. What he did say this week, and it had to do more with what he wasn't going to do when it comes to Medicaid, he says he is not going to follow the lead of other Republican governors and accept Obamacare money to expand the program.
And I mentioned Indiana.
Yes. So why are we talking about this? Indiana Governor Mike Pence, who, like Walker, is also considering a run for president, announced this week that he would be accepting the money so that his state could craft its own version of Medicaid.
All right. Well, I imagine when we talk to you next week about reactions to what the governor says on Tuesday, we'll be covering that all over the place in news and on the Ideas
Network. It's going to be a big day for sure.
All right, Noah, thanks as always.
It was good to be here. Thanks, Rob.
That's Noah Ovchinsky, assistant news director here at WPR. He joins us each week for a look at the top news stories from around the state.
I'm Veronica Vickers.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.